24 fresh eggs. She put her basket on the table. The boy said, Cook's not up yet. You'll have to wait for your money. Can I get a bite of bread for my breakfast? In the great hall. Thank you. She left her basket and went out again. She crossed the second drawbridge to the upper compound. She smiled at the guard in the second gateway. He had uncombed hair and bloodshot eyes. He looked her up and down and said, And where are you going? His voice was playfully challenging. To get some breakfast, she said without stopping. He leered. I've got something for you to eat, he called after her. I might bite it off, though, she said over her shoulder. They did not suspect her for a moment. It did not occur to them that a woman could be dangerous. How foolish they were. Women could do most of the things men did. Who was left in charge when the men were fighting wars or going on crusades? There were women carpenters, dyers, tanners, bakers, and brewers. Aliena herself was one of the most important merchants in the county. The duties of an abbess running a nunnery were exactly the same as those of an abbot. Why, it had been a woman, the Empress Maud, who caused the civil war that had gone on for 15 years. Yet these wooden-headed men-at-arms did not expect a woman to be an enemy agent because it was not the normal thing. She ran up the steps of the keep and entered the hall. There was no steward at the door. That was presumably because the master was away. In future, I will make sure there is always a steward at the door, Aliena thought, whether the master is at home or not. 15 or 20 people were eating breakfast around a small table. One or two of them glanced up at her, but nobody took any notice. The hall was quite clean, she observed, and there were one or two feminine touches, freshly whitewashed walls and sweet-smelling herbs mixed with the rushes on the floor. Elizabeth had made her mark in a small way. That was a hopeful sign. Without speaking to the people around the table, Aliena walked across the hall to the staircase in the corner, trying to look as if she had every right to be there, but expecting at any moment to be stopped. She got to the foot of the stairs without attracting attention. Then, as she ran up toward the private apartments on the top floor, she heard someone say, "You can't go up there! Hey, you!" She ignored the voice. She heard someone come after her. She reached the top, panting. Would Elizabeth sleep in the main bedroom, the one Aliena's father had occupied? Or would she have a bed of her own in the room that had been Aliena's? She hesitated for an instant, her heart pounding. She guessed that by now William had tired of having Elizabeth sleep with him every night, and probably allowed her a room of her own. Aliena knocked at the smaller room and opened the door. She had been right. Elizabeth was sitting by the fire wearing a nightshirt, brushing her hair. She looked up, frowned, and then recognized Aliena. "It's you," she said. "What a surprise!" She seemed pleased. Aliena heard heavy footsteps on the stairs behind her. "May I come in?" she said. "Of course, and welcome!" Aliena stepped inside and closed the door quickly. She crossed the room to where Elizabeth sat. A man burst in saying, "Hey, you, who do you think you are?" and came after Aliena as if to seize her. "Stay where you are," she said in her most commanding voice. He hesitated. She said, "I come to see the Countess with a message from Earl William, and you would have learned that earlier if you had been guarding the door instead of stuffing your face with horse bread." He looked guilty. Elizabeth said, "It's all right, Edgar. I know this lady." "Very well, Countess," he said. He went out and closed the door. "I made it," Aliena thought. "I got in." She looked around while her heartbeat returned to normal. The room was not very different from when it had been hers. There were dried petals in a bowl, a pretty tapestry on the wall, some books and a trunk for clothes. The bed was in the same place, in fact, it was the same bed, and on the pillow was a rag doll just like the one Aliena had had. It made her feel old. "This used to be my room," she said. "I know," said Elizabeth. Aliena was surprised. She had not told Elizabeth about her past. "I've found out all about you since that terrible storm," Elizabeth explained. She added, "I admire you so much, She had the gleam of hero worship in her eyes. That was a good sign. "And William?" Aliena said. "Are you any happier, living with him?" Elizabeth looked away. "Well," she said, "I have my own room now, and he's been away a lot. In fact, everything's much better." Then she began to cry. Aliena sat on the bed and put her arms around the girl. Elizabeth cried with deep, wrenching sobs, and tears flooded down her cheeks. In between sobs she gasped, "I hate him. I wish I could die." Her anguish was so pitiful, and she was so young, that Aliena was close to tears herself. She was painfully aware that Elizabeth's fate could easily have been her own. She patted Elizabeth's back as she would have done with Sally. Eventually, Elizabeth became calmer. She wiped her wet face with the sleeve of her nightshirt. "I'm so afraid of having a baby," she said miserably. "I'm terrified because I know how he would mistreat the child." "I understand," Aliena said. She had once been terrified by the thought that she might be pregnant with William's child. Elizabeth looked at her wide-eyed. "Is it true what they say about what he did to you?" "Yes, it's true. I was your age when it happened." For a moment they looked into one another's eyes, brought close by a shared loathing. Suddenly Elizabeth did not look like a child anymore. Aliena said, "You could get free of him if you want. Today." Elizabeth stared at her. "Is it true?" she said with pitiable eagerness. "Is it true?" Aliena nodded. "That's why I'm here." "I could go home," Elizabeth said, her eyes filling with fresh tears. "I could go home to Weymouth, to my mother. Today." "Yes, but you'll have to be brave. I'll do anything," she said. "Anything. Just tell me." Aliena remembered explaining how she could acquire authority with her husband's employees, and she wondered whether Elizabeth had been able to put the principles into practice. "Do the servants still push you around?" she asked candidly.
"They try."
"But you don't let them." She looked embarrassed.
"Well, sometimes I do, but I'm 16 now, and I've been countess for nearly 2 years. And I've been trying to follow your advice, and it really works."
"Let me explain," Aliena began. "King Stephen has made a pact with Duke Henry. All lands are to be returned to the people who held them in the time of the old King Henry. That means my brother Richard will become Earl of Shiring. Sometime. But he wants it now." Elizabeth was wide-eyed. "Is Richard going to make war on William?" "Richard is very close right now with a small company of men. If he can take over the castle today, he will be recognized as Earl, and William will be finished."
"I can't believe it," Elizabeth said. "I can't believe it's really true."
Her sudden optimism was even more heartrending than her abject misery had been. "All you have to do is let Richard in peacefully," Aliena said. "Then when it's all over, we'll take you home." Elizabeth looked fearful again.
"I'm not sure the men will do what I say."
That was Aliena's worry. "Who is the captain of the guard?"
"Michael Armstrong. I don't like him."
"Send for him."
"Right."
Elizabeth wiped her nose, stood up, and went to the door.
"Madge!"
she called out in a piercing voice. Aliena heard a distant reply.
"Go and fetch Michael. Tell him to come here right away. I want to see him urgently. Hurry, please."
She came back in and began to dress quickly, throwing a tunic over her nightdress and lacing up her boots. Aliena briefed her rapidly. "Tell Michael to ring the big bell to summon everyone to the courtyard. Say you've received a message from Earl William and you want to speak to the entire garrison, men-at-arms and servants and everyone. You want 3 or 4 men to stand guard while everyone else gathers in the lower courtyard. Also tell him you're expecting a group of 10 or 12 horsemen to arrive at any moment with a further message, and they must be brought to you as soon as they arrive."
"I hope I can remember it all," Elizabeth said nervously.
"Don't worry. If you forget, I'll prompt you."
"That makes me feel better." What's Michael Armstrong like? Smelly and surly and built like an ox.
Intelligent?
No.
So much the better. A moment later, the man came in. He had a grumpy expression, a short neck, and massive shoulders, and he brought with him the odor of the pigsty. He looked inquiringly at Elizabeth, giving the impression that he resented being disturbed.
"I've received a message from the Earl,"
Elizabeth began. Michael held out his hand. Aliena was horrified to realize that she had not taken the precaution of providing Elizabeth with a letter. The whole deception could collapse right at the outset because of a silly mistake. Elizabeth threw her a despairing look. Aliena cast about frantically for something to say. Finally, she was inspired.
"Can you read, Michael?"
He looked resentful. "The priest will read it to me."
"Your lady can read."
Elizabeth looked scared, but she said,
"I shall give the message to the whole garrison myself, Michael. Ring the bell and get everyone assembled in the courtyard, but make sure to leave 3 or 4 men on guard on the ramparts."
As Aliena had feared, Michael did not like Elizabeth taking command like this. He looked rebellious. "Why not let me address them?" Aliena realized anxiously that she might not be able to persuade this man. He could be too stupid to listen to reason. She said, "I have brought the Countess momentous news from Winchester. She wants to tell her people herself."
"Well, what is the news?"
he said. Aliena said nothing and looked at Elizabeth. Once again, Elizabeth looked scared. However, Aliena had not told her what was supposed to be in the fictitious message, so Elizabeth could not possibly accede to Michael's request. In the end, she simply went on as if Michael had not spoken. "Tell the guards to look out for a group of 10 or 12 horsemen. Their leader will have fresh news from Earl William, and he must be brought to me immediately. Now, ring the bell." Michael was clearly disposed to argue. He stood still, frowning, while Aliena held her breath. "More messengers," he said, as if it was something very difficult to understand. "This lady with one message, and 12 horsemen with another."
"Yes. Now, would you please go and ring the bell?"
Elizabeth said. Aliena could hear the quaver in her voice. Michael looked defeated. He could not understand what was happening, but he saw nothing to object to either. Finally, he said a grudging, "Very well, lady," and went out. Aliena breathed again. Elizabeth said,
"What's going to happen?"
"When they're gathered in the courtyard, you'll tell them about the peace between King Stephen and Duke Henry," Aliena said. "That will distract everyone. While you're speaking, Richard will send out an advance party of 10 men. However, the guards will think they are the messengers we are expecting from Earl William, so they won't immediately panic and raise the drawbridge. You have to try to keep everyone interested in what you're saying while the advance party approaches the castle. All right?" Elizabeth looked nervous. She said,
"And then what? When I give you the word, say you have surrendered the castle to the rightful Earl, Richard. Then Richard's army will break cover and charge the castle. At that point, Michael will realize what's happening, but his men will be in doubt about their loyalty because you have told them to surrender and called Richard the rightful Earl, and the advance party will be inside to prevent anyone from closing the gates."
The bell began to ring. Aliena's stomach knotted in fear.
"We've run out of time. How do you feel?"
"Scared."
"Me too. Let's go."
They went down the stairs. The bell on the gatehouse tower was ringing as it had when Aliena was a carefree girl. Same bell, same sound. Different Aliena, she thought. She knew it could be heard all across the fields, as far away as the edge of the forest. Richard would by now be saying the Paternoster, slowly, under his breath, to measure the time he had to wait before sending his advance party. Aliena and Elizabeth walked from the keep, across the internal drawbridge to the lower courtyard. Elizabeth was pale with fear, but her mouth was set in a determined line. Aliena smiled at her to give her courage, then pulled up her hood again. So far she had not seen anyone familiar, but she was a well-known face all over the county, and someone was sure to recognize her sooner or later. If Michael Armstrong were to find out who she was, he might smell a rat,
dim-witted though he undoubtedly was. Several people gave her curious glances, but no one spoke to her. She and Elizabeth went to the middle of the lower courtyard. Because the ground sloped somewhat, Aliena could see over the heads of the crowd and through the main gate to the fields outside. The advance party should be breaking cover about now, but she could see no sign of them. "Oh, God, I hope there's no snag," she thought fearfully. Elizabeth would need something to stand on while she addressed the people. Aliena told a manservant to fetch a mounting block from the stable. While they were waiting, an elderly woman looked at Aliena and said,
"Why, it's the Lady Aliena! How nice to see you!"
Aliena's heart sank. She recognized the woman as a cook who had worked at the castle before the coming of the Hamleys. She forced a smile and said,
"Hello, Tilly. How are you?"
Tilly nudged her neighbor.
"Hey, it's the Lady Aliena come back after all these years. Are you going to be mistress again, lady?"
Aliena did not want the thought to occur to Michael Armstrong. She looked around anxiously. Happily, Michael was not within earshot. However, one of his men-at-arms had heard the exchange and was staring at Aliena with a furrowed brow. Aliena looked back at him with a simulated expression of unconcern. The man only had one eye, which no doubt was why he had been left behind here instead of going off to war with William, and it suddenly seemed funny to Aliena to be stared at by a man with one eye, and she had to choke back a laugh. She realized she was slightly hysterical. The manservant came back with the mounting block. The bell ceased to toll. Aliena made herself calm as Elizabeth stood on the block and the crowd went quiet. Elizabeth said,
"King Stephen and Duke Henry have made peace."
She paused, and a cheer went up. Aliena was looking through the gateway. "Now, Richard," she thought, "now is the time. Don't leave it too late." Elizabeth smiled and let the people cheer for a while. Then she went on,
"Stephen is to remain king until he dies. Then Henry will succeed him."
Aliena scrutinized the guards on the towers and over the gatehouse. They looked relaxed. Where was Richard?
Elizabeth said, "The peace treaty will bring many changes in our lives."
Aliena saw the guards stiffen. One of them raised his hand to shade his eyes and peered out over the fields, while another turned and looked down into the courtyard as if hoping to catch the eye of the captain. But Michael Armstrong was listening intently to Elizabeth.
"The present and future kings have agreed that all lands shall be returned to those who possessed them in the time of the old King Henry."
That caused a buzz of comment in the crowd, as people speculated whether this change would affect the earldom of Shiring. Aliena noticed Michael Armstrong looking thoughtful. Through the gateway she at last saw the horses of Richard's advance party. "Hurry," she thought, "hurry." But they were coming at a steady trot so as not to alarm the guards. Elizabeth was saying,
"We must all give thanks to God for this peace treaty. We should pray that King Stephen will rule wisely in his declining years, and that the young Duke will keep his peace until God takes Stephen away."
She was doing magnificently, but she was beginning to look troubled, as if she might be about to run out of things to say. All the guards were looking outward, examining the approaching party. They had been told to expect such a group, and instructed to bring the leader to the Countess immediately, so no action was required of them, but they were curious. The one-eyed man turned around and looked through the gate, then turned back and stared at Aliena again, and she guessed he was frowning over the significance of her presence here and the approach of a troop of horsemen. One of the guards on the battlements appeared to make a decision and disappeared down a staircase. The crowd was getting a little restless. Elizabeth was meandering magnificently, but they were impatient for hard news. She said,
"This war started within a year of my birth, and like many young people up and down the kingdom, I am looking forward to finding out what peace is like."
The guard from the battlements emerged from the base of a tower, walked briskly across the compound, and spoke to Michael Armstrong. Through the gateway, Aliena could see that the horsemen were still a couple of hundred yards away. It was not close enough. She could have screamed in frustration. She would not be able to contain this situation much longer. Michael Armstrong turned and looked through the gate, frowning. Then the one-eyed man pulled Michael's sleeve and said something, pointing at Aliena. Aliena was afraid Michael would close the gates and raise the drawbridge before Richard could get in, but she did not know what she could do to prevent him. She wondered whether she had the nerve to throw herself at him before he could give the order. She still wore her dagger strapped to her left arm. She could even kill him. He turned away decisively. Aliena reached up and touched Elizabeth's elbow. "Stop, Michael!" she hissed. Elizabeth opened her mouth to speak, but no sound came out. She looked petrified by fear. Then her expression changed. She took a deep breath, tilted her head up, and spoke in a voice ringing with authority. "Michael Armstrong!" Michael turned back. This was the point of no return, Aliena realized. Richard was not quite close enough, but she had run out of time. She said to Elizabeth, "Now, tell them now." Elizabeth said, "I have surrendered this castle to the rightful Earl of Shiring, Richard of Kingsbridge." Michael stared unbelievingly at Elizabeth. "You can't do that!" he shouted. Elizabeth said, "I command you all to lay down your weapons. There is to be no bloodshed." Michael turned around and yelled, "Raise the drawbridge! Shut the gates!" The men-at-arms rushed to do his bidding, but he had hesitated a moment too long. As the men reached the massive iron-bound doors that would close the entrance arch, Richard's advance party clattered over the drawbridge and entered the compound. Most of Michael's men were not wearing armor, and some of them did not even have their swords, and they scattered in front of the horsemen. Elizabeth shouted, "Everyone keep calm! These messengers will confirm my orders." There was a shout from the battlements. One of the guards cupped his hands around his mouth and yelled down, "Michael! Attack! We're being attacked! Scores of them!" "Treachery!" Michael roared and drew his sword. But two of Richard's men were on him instantly, their blades flashing. Blood gushed and he went down. Aliena looked away. Some of Richard's men had taken possession of the gatehouse and the winding room. Two of them made it to the battlements, and Michael's guard surrendered to them. Through the gateway, Aliena saw the main force galloping across the fields toward the castle, and her spirits rose like the sun. Elizabeth shouted at the top of her voice, "This is a peaceful surrender! No one is going to be hurt, I promise you! Just stay where you are!" Everyone stood stock still, listening to the thunder as Richard's army pounded closer. Michael's men-at-arms looked confused and uncertain, but none of them did anything. Their leader had fallen, and their countess had told them to surrender. The castle servants were paralyzed by the rapidity of events. Then Richard came through the gateway on his warhorse. It was a great moment, and Aliena's heart swelled with pride. Richard was handsome, smiling, and triumphant. Aliena shouted, "The rightful Earl!" The men entering the castle behind Richard took up the cry, and it was repeated by some of the crowd in the courtyard. Most of them had no love for William. Richard rode around the compound at a slow walk, waving and acknowledging the cheers. Aliena thought about all she had gone through for the sake of this moment. She was 34 years old, and she had spent half of those years fighting for this. "The whole of my adult life," she thought. "That's what I gave." She remembered stuffing wool into sacks until her hands were red and swollen and bleeding. She recalled the faces she had seen on the road, greedy and cruel and lascivious faces of men who would have killed her if she had given the least sign of weakness. She thought of how she had hardened her heart against dear Jack and married Alfred instead. And she thought of the months during which she had slept on the floor at the foot of his bed like a dog, and all because she had promised to pay for weapons and armor so that Richard could fight to win back this castle. "There it is, Father," she said aloud. Nobody heard her. They were cheering too loud. "This is what you wanted," she said to her dead father, and there was bitterness as well as triumph in her heart. "I promised you this, and I kept my promise. I took care of Richard, and he fought all these years, and now we're home again at last. And Richard is the Earl." "Now!" Her voice rose to a shout, but everyone was shouting, and no one noticed the tears rolling down her cheeks. "Now, Father, I've done with you. So go to your grave and let me live in peace." Chapter 16. Remigius was arrogant, even in penury. He entered the wooden manor house at Hamley Village with his head held high, and looked down his long nose at the huge, rough-hewn wooden crux supporting the roof, the wattle and daub walls, and the chimneyless open fire in the middle of the beaten earth floor. William watched him walk in. "I may be down on my luck, but I'm not as far down as you," he thought, noting the monk's much-repaired sandals, the grubby robe, the unshaven chin and the unkempt hair. Remigius had never been a fat man, but now he was thinner than ever. The haughty expression fixed on his face failed to conceal the lines of exhaustion or the purplish folds of defeat under his eyes. Remigius was not yet bowed, but he was very badly beaten. "Bless you, my son," he said to William. William was not having any of that. "What do you want, Remigius?" he said, deliberately insulting the monk by not calling him father or brother. Remigius flinched as if he had been struck. William guessed he had received a few taunts of that kind since he came down in the world. Remigius said, "The lands you gave to me as dean of the chapter at Shiring have been repossessed by Earl Richard." "I'm not surprised," William replied. "Everything is to be returned to those who possessed it in the time of the old King Henry. But that leaves me with no means of support." "You and a lot of other people," William said carelessly. "You'll have to go back to Kingsbridge." Remigius's face paled with anger. "I can't do that," he said in a low voice.
"Why not?"
said William, tormenting him. "You know why not.
Would Philip say you shouldn't prize secrets out of little girls? Does he think you betrayed him by telling me where the outlaw's hideout was?
Would he be angry with you for becoming the dean of a church that was to take the place of his own cathedral?"
"Well, then, I suppose you can't go back."
"Give me something," Remigius pleaded. "One village, a farm, a little church."
"There are no rewards for losing, monk," William said harshly. He was enjoying this. "In the world outside the monastery, nobody looks after you. The ducks swallow the worms, and the foxes kill the ducks, and the men shoot the foxes, and the devil hunts the men."
Remigius's voice sank to a whisper. "What am I to do?" William smiled and said, "Beg." Remigius turned on his heel and left the house. Still proud, William thought, but not for long. "You'll beg." It pleased him to see someone who had fallen harder than he himself. He would never forget the excruciating agony of standing outside the gate of his own castle and being refused admittance. He had been suspicious when he heard that Richard and some of his men had left Winchester. Then, when the peace pact was announced, his unease had turned to alarm, and he had taken his knights and men and ridden hard to Earl's castle. There was a skeleton force guarding the castle, so he expected to find Richard camped in the fields, laying siege. When all appeared peaceful, he had been relieved, and berated himself for overreacting to Richard's sudden disappearance. When he got closer, he saw that the drawbridge was up. He had reined in at the edge of the moat and shouted, "Open up for the Earl!" That was when Richard had appeared on the battlements and said, "The Earl is inside!" It was like the ground falling away from under William's feet. He had always been afraid of Richard, always aware of him as a dangerous rival, but he had not felt himself especially vulnerable at this moment in time. He had thought the real danger would come when Stephen died and Henry came to the throne, which might be 10 years away. Now, as he sat in a mean manor house brooding over his mistakes, he realized bitterly that Richard had in fact been very clever. He had slipped through a narrow gap. He could not be accused of breaching the king's peace, as the war was still on. His claim to the earldom had been legitimized by the terms of the peace treaty, and Stephen, aging and tired and defeated, had no energy left for further battles. Richard had magnanimously released those of William's men-at-arms who wanted to continue in William's service. Waldo One-Eye had told William how the castle had been taken. The treachery of Elizabeth was maddening, but for William it was the part played by Aliena that was most humiliating. The helpless little girl he had raped and tormented and thrown out of her home all those years ago had come back and taken her revenge. Every time he thought of that, his stomach burned with bitterness as if he had drunk vinegar. His first inclination had been to fight Richard. William could have kept his army, lived off the countryside, and extorted taxes and supplies from the peasants, fighting a running battle with his rival. But Richard held the castle, and he had time on his side, for William's supporter Stephen was old and beaten, and Richard was backed by the young Duke Henry, who would eventually become the second King Henry. So William had decided to cut his losses. He had retired to the village of Hamley and moved back into the manor house, where he had been brought up. Hamley and the villages surrounding it had been granted to his father 30 years ago. It was a holding that had never been part of the earldom, so Richard had no claim to it. William hoped that if he kept his head down, Richard would be satisfied with the revenge he had already taken, and would leave him alone. So far it had worked. However, William hated the village of Hamley. He hated the small, neat houses, the excitable ducks on the pond, the pale grey stone church, the apple-cheeked children, the broad-hipped women, and the strong, resentful men. He hated it for being humble, plain, and poor, and he hated it because it symbolized his family's fall from power. He watched the plodding peasants begin the spring ploughing, and estimated what his share of the crop would be that summer, and he found it meager. He went hunting in his few acres of forest and failed to start a single deer, and the forester said to him, "The boar is all you can hunt now, Lord. The outlaws had the deer in the famine." He held court in the great hall of the manor house, with the wind whistling through the holes in its wattle and daub walls, and he gave harsh judgments and imposed large fines, and ruled according to his whim, but it brought him little satisfaction. He had abandoned the building of the grand new church at Shiring, of course. He could not afford to build a stone house for himself, let alone a church. The builders had stopped work when he had stopped paying them, and what had happened to them he did not know. Perhaps they had all gone back to Kingsbridge to work for Prior Philip. But now he was having nightmares. They were all the same. He saw his mother in the place of the dead. She was bleeding from her eyes and ears, and when she opened her mouth to speak, more blood came out. The sight filled him with mortal terror. In broad daylight he could not say what it was about the dream that he feared, for she did not threaten him in any way. But at night, when she came to him, the fear possessed him totally, an irrational, hysterical, blind panic. Once, as a boy, he had waded into a pond that suddenly got deeper, and he had found himself below the surface and unable to breathe, and the overpowering need for air that had possessed him then was one of the indelible memories of his childhood. But this was 10 times as bad. Trying to get away from his mother's bloody face was like trying to sprint in quicksand. He would come awake as if he had been thrown across the room, violently shocked, sweating and moaning, his body taut with agony from the racked-up tension. Walter would be at his bedside with a candle. William slept in the hall, separated from the men by a screen, for there was no bedroom here. "You cried out, Lord," Walter would murmur. William would breathe hard, staring at the real bed and the real wall and the real Walter, while the power of the nightmare slowly faded to the point where he was no longer afraid. And then he would say, "It was nothing. A dream. Go away." But he would be frightened to go back to sleep, and the next day the men would look at him as if he were bewitched. A few days after his conversation with Remigius, he was sitting in the same hard chair by the same smoky fire when Bishop Walleran walked in. William was startled. He had heard horses, but he had assumed it was Walter coming back from the mill. He did not know what to do when he saw the bishop. Walleran had always been arrogant and superior, and time again he had made William feel foolish, clumsy, and coarse. It was humiliating that Walleran should see the humble surroundings in which he now lived. William did not get up to greet his visitor. "What do you want?" he said curtly. He had no reason to be polite. He wanted Walleran to get out as soon as possible. The bishop ignored his rudeness. "The sheriff is dead," he said. At first William did not see what he was getting at. "What's that to me?" "There will be a new sheriff." William was about to say, "So what?" but he stopped himself. Walleran was concerned about who would be the new sheriff, and he had come to talk to William about it. That could only mean one thing, couldn't it? Hope rose in his breast, but he suppressed it fiercely. Where Walleran was involved, high hopes often ended in frustration and disappointment. He said, "Who have you got in mind?"
"You."
It was the answer William had not dared to hope for. He wished he could believe in it. A clever and ruthless sheriff could be almost as important and influential as an earl or a bishop. This could be his way back to wealth and power. He forced himself to consider the snags. Why would King Stephen appoint me?
You supported him against Duke Henry, and as a result you lost your earldom.
I imagine he would like to recompense you. Nobody ever does anything out of gratitude, William said, repeating a saying of his mother's. Walleran said, Stephen can't be happy that the Earl of Shiring is a man who fought against him. He might want his sheriff to be a countervailing force against Richard. Now that made more sense. William felt excited against his will. He began to believe that he might actually get out of this hole in the ground called Hamley Village. He would have a respectable force of knights and men-at-arms again, instead of the pitiful handful he now supported. He would preside over the county court at Shiring and frustrate Richard's will. The sheriff lives at Shiring Castle, he said longingly.
You'd be rich again,
Walleran added.
Yes.
Properly exploited, the sheriff's post could be hugely profitable. William would make almost as much money as he had when he was earl. But he wondered why Walleran had mentioned it. A moment later, Walleran answered the question. You would be able to finance the new church, after all. So that was it. Walleran never did anything without an ulterior motive. He wanted William to be sheriff so that William could build him a church. But William was willing to go along with the plan. If he could finish the church in memory of his mother, perhaps the nightmares would stop. Do you really think it can be done? He said eagerly. Walleran nodded. It will cost money, of course, but I think it can be done.
Money?
William said with sudden anxiety. How much?
It's hard to say. In somewhere like Lincoln or Bristol, the shrievalty would cost you £500 or £600.
But the sheriffs of those towns are richer than cardinals.
For a little place, such as Shiring, if you're the candidate the king wants, which I can take care of, you can probably get it for £100.
£100? William's hopes collapsed. He had been afraid of disappointment right from the start. If I had £100, I wouldn't be living like this, he said bitterly.
You can get it, Walleran said lightly.
Who from? William was struck by a thought.
Will you give it to me?
Don't be stupid, Walleran said with infuriating condescension. That's what Jews are for. William realized, with a familiar mixture of hope and resentment, that once again the bishop was right. It was 2 years since the first cracks had appeared, and Jack had not found a solution to the problem. Worse still, identical cracks had appeared in the first bay of the nave. There was something crucially wrong with his design. The structure was strong enough to support the weight of the vault, but not to resist the winds that blew so hard against the high walls. He stood on the scaffolding far above the ground, staring close range at the new cracks brooding. He needed to think of a way of bracing the upper part of the wall so that it would not move with the wind. He reflected on the way the lower part of the wall was strengthened. In the outer wall of the aisle were strong, thick piers which were connected to the nave wall by half-arches, hidden in the aisle roof. The half-arches and the piers propped up the wall at a distance, like remote buttresses. Because the props were hidden, the nave looked light and graceful. He needed to devise a similar system for the upper part of the wall. He could make a two-story side aisle and simply repeat the remote buttressing, but that would block the light coming in through the clerestory, and the whole idea of the new style of building was to bring more light into the church. Of course, it was not the aisle as such that did the work. The support came from the heavy piers in the side wall and the connecting half-arches. The aisle concealed these structural elements. If only he could build piers and half-arches to support the clerestory without incorporating them into an aisle, he could solve the problem at a stroke. A voice called him from the ground. He frowned. He had been on to something before he was interrupted, he felt, but now it had gone. He looked down. Prior Philip was calling him. He went into the turret and descended the spiral staircase. Philip was waiting for him at the bottom. The prior was so angry he was steaming. "Richard has betrayed me," he said without preamble. Jack was surprised. "How?" Philip did not answer the question at first. "After all I've done for him," he raged, "I bought Alina's wool when everyone else was bent on cheating her. If it hadn't been for me, she might never have got started. Then when that fell apart, I got him a job as head of the watch. And last November I tipped him off about the peace treaty, and that enabled him to seize Earl's castle. And now that he's won back the earldom, and he's ruling in splendour, he has turned his back on me." Jack had never seen Philip quite so livid. The prior's shaved head was red with indignation, and he was spluttering as he spoke. "In what way has Richard betrayed you?" Jack said. Once again Philip ignored the question. "I always knew Richard was a weak character. He gave Aliena very little support over the years. Just took from her what he wanted and never considered her needs. But I didn't think he was an out-and-out villain." "What exactly has he done?" At last Philip told him. "He has refused to give us access to the quarry." Jack was shocked. This was an act of astonishing ingratitude. "But how does he justify himself?" "Everything is supposed to revert to those who possessed it in the time of the first King Henry, and the quarry was granted to us by King Stephen." Richard's greed was remarkable, but Jack could not get as angry as Philip. They had built half the cathedral now, mostly with stone they had had to pay for, and they would continue to get by somehow. "Well, I suppose Richard is in the right, strictly speaking," he said argumentatively. Philip was outraged. "How can you say such a thing?"
"It's a bit like what you did to me," Jack said. "After I brought you the Weeping Madonna and produced a wonderful design for your new cathedral and built a town wall to protect you from William, you announced that I couldn't live with the woman who is the mother of my children. There's ingratitude."
Philip was shocked by this parallel.
"That's completely different," he protested. "I don't want you to live apart. It's Walleran who has blocked the annulment, but God's law says you must not commit adultery."
"I'm sure Richard would say something similar," Jack persisted.
"It's not Richard who has ordered the reversion of property. He is just enforcing the law." The noon bell rang. "There's a difference between God's laws and men's laws," Philip said.
"But we must live by both," Jack countered. "And now I'm going to have dinner with the mother of my children."
He walked away and left Philip standing there, looking upset. He did not really think Philip was as ungrateful as Richard, but it had relieved his feelings to pretend that he did. He decided he would ask Aliena about the quarry. It might be that Richard could be persuaded to hand it over after all. She would know. He left the priory close and walked through the streets to the house where he lived with Martha. Aliena and the children were in the kitchen as usual. The famine had ended with a good harvest last year, and food was no longer desperately scarce. There was wheat bread and roast mutton on the table. Jack kissed the children. Sally gave him a soft, childish kiss, but Tommy, now 11 years old and impatient to grow up, offered his cheek and looked embarrassed. Jack smiled but said nothing. He remembered when he had thought kissing was silly. Aliena looked troubled. Jack sat on the bench beside her and said, "Philip's in a rage because Richard won't give him the quarry."
"That's terrible," Aliena said mildly. "How ungrateful of Richard."
"Do you think he might be persuaded to change his mind?"
"I really don't know," she said. She had a distracted air.
Jack said, "You don't seem very interested in the problem." She looked at him challengingly.
"No, I'm not."
He knew this mood. "You'd better tell me what's on your mind." She stood up. "Let's go into the back room." With a regretful look at the leg of mutton, Jack left the table and followed her into the bedroom. They left the door open as usual to avoid suspicion if someone should come into the house. Aliena sat on the bed and folded her arms across her chest.
"I've made an important decision," she began.
She looked so grave that Jack wondered what on earth it could be.
"I've lived most of my adult life under two shadows," she began.
"One was the vow I made to my father when he was dying. The other is my relationship with you." Jack said, "But now you've fulfilled your vow to your father."
"Yes,
and I want to be free of the other burden, too. I've decided to leave you." Jack's heart seemed to stop. He knew she did not say such things lightly. She was serious. He stared at her, speechless. He was disoriented by the announcement. He had never dreamed she could leave him. How had this dreadful thing crept up on him? He said the first thing that came into his head.
"Is there someone else?"
"Don't be daft."
"Then why?"
"Because I can't take it any more," she said, and her eyes brimmed with tears. "We've been waiting 10 years for this annulment. It's never going to come, Jack. We're doomed to live this way forever, unless we part."
"But—"
He cast around for something to say. Her announcement was so devastating that arguing with it seemed hopeless, like trying to walk away from a hurricane. Nevertheless, he tried.
"Isn't this better than nothing, better than separation? In the end?"
"No."
"But how will it change anything if you move away?"
"I might meet someone else and fall in love again and live a normal life," she said, but she was crying.
"You'll still be married to Alfred."
"But nobody will know or care. I could be married by a parish priest who has never heard of Alfred Builder and who wouldn't consider the marriage valid if he knew of it."
"I don't believe you're saying this. I can't take it in."
10 years, Jack. I've been waiting 10 years to have a normal life with you. I won't wait any longer." The words fell on him like blows. She carried on talking, but he no longer understood her. All he could think about was life without her. He interrupted her.
"I've never loved anyone else, you see."
She winced as if she was in pain, but she went on with what she was saying.
"I need a few weeks to arrange everything. I'll get a house in Winchester. I want the children to get used to the idea before their new life begins."
"You're going to take my children," he said stupidly. She nodded.
"I'm sorry," she said.
For the first time her resolve seemed to waver. "I know they'll miss you, but they need a normal life, too." Jack could not take any more. He turned away. Aliena said, "Don't walk out on me. We ought to talk some more. Jack!" He went out without replying. He heard her cry out after him, "Jack!" He walked through the living room, not looking at the children, and left the house. In a daze, he walked back to the cathedral, not knowing where else to go. The builders were still at lunch. He was unable to weep. This was too bad for mere tears. Without thinking, he climbed the staircase in the north transept all the way up to the top and stepped out onto the roof. There was a stiff breeze up here, although at ground level it had hardly been noticeable. Jack looked down. If he fell from here, he would land on the lean-to roof of the aisle alongside the transept. He would probably die, but it was not certain. He walked to the crossing and stood where the roof suddenly ended in a sheer drop. If the new-style cathedral was not structurally sound, and Aliena was leaving him, he had nothing left to live for. Her decision was not as sudden as it seemed, of course. She had been discontented for years, they both had, but they had got accustomed to unhappiness. Winning back Earl's castle had shaken Aliena's torpor and reminded her that she was in charge of her own life. It had destabilized a situation that was already unsteady, rather in the way that the storm had caused cracks in the cathedral walls. He looked at the wall of the transept and the roof of the side aisle. He could see the heavy buttresses jutting out from the wall of the side aisle, and he could visualize the half-arch under the roof of the aisle, connecting the buttress to the foot of the clerestory. What would solve the problem, he had thought, just before Philip had distracted him this morning, was a taller buttress. Perhaps another 20 feet high, with a second half-arch leaping across the gap to the point on the wall where the cracks were appearing. The arch and the tall buttress would brace the top half of the church and keep the wall rigid when the wind blew. That would probably solve the problem. The trouble was, if he built a two-story aisle to hide the extended buttress and the secondary half-arch, he would lose light. And if he did not... If I don't, he thought, so what? He was possessed by a feeling that nothing mattered very much, since his life was falling apart, and in that mood he could not see anything wrong with the idea of naked buttressing. Standing up here on the roof, he could easily picture what it would look like. A line of sturdy stone columns would rise up from the side wall of the aisle. From the top of each column, a half-arch would spring across empty space to the clerestory. Perhaps he would put a decorative pinnacle on top of each column, above the springing of the arch. Yes, that would look better. It was a revolutionary idea, to build big strengthening members in a position where they would be starkly visible. But it was part of the new style to show how the building was being held up. Anyway, his instinct said this was right. The more he thought about it, the better he liked it. He visualized the church from the west. The half-arches would look like the wings of a flight of birds, all in a line, just about to take off. They need not be massive. As long as they were well made, they could be slender and elegant, light yet strong, just like a bird's wing. Winged buttresses, he thought, for a church so light it could fly. I wonder, he thought, I wonder if it would work. A gust of wind suddenly unbalanced him. He teetered on the edge of the roof. For a moment he thought he was going to fall to his death. Then he regained his balance and stepped back from the edge, his heart pounding. Slowly and carefully he made his way back along the roof to the turret door and went down. 2. Work had stopped completely on the church at Shiring. Prior Philip caught himself gloating a little over that. After all the times he had looked out disconsolately onto a deserted building site, he could not help feeling pleased that the same thing had now happened to his enemies. Alfred Builder had only had time to demolish the old church and lay the foundations for the new chancel before William had been deposed and the money had dried up. Philip told himself that it was sinful to be glad about the ruin of a church. However, it was obviously God's will that the cathedral should be built in Kingsbridge, not Shiring. The bad fortune that had dogged Walleran's project seemed a very clear sign of divine intentions. Now that the town's biggest church had been knocked down, the county court was held in the great hall at the castle. Philip rode up the hill with Jonathan by his side. He had made Jonathan his personal assistant in the shake-up that had followed the defection of Remigius. Philip had been shocked by Remigius's perfidy, but he had been glad to see the back of him. Ever since Philip had beaten Remigius in the election, Remigius had been a thorn in his flesh. The priory was a nicer place to live, now that he had gone. Milius was the new sub-prior. However, he continued to fulfill the role of treasurer and had a staff of three under him in the treasury. Since Remigius had gone, nobody could figure out what he used to do all day. Philip got deep satisfaction out of working with Jonathan. He enjoyed explaining to him how the monastery was run, educating him in the ways of the world, and showing him how best to deal with people. The lad was generally well-liked, but he could sometimes be abrasive, and he could easily raise the hackles of unself-confident people. He had to learn that those who treated him in a hostile way did so out of weakness. He saw the hostility and reacted angrily, instead of seeing the weakness and giving reassurance. Jonathan had a quick brain and often surprised Philip by the rapidity with which he picked things up. Philip sometimes caught himself in the sin of pride, thinking how like himself Jonathan was. He had brought Jonathan with him today to learn how the county court operated. Philip was going to ask the sheriff to order Richard to open the quarry to the priory. He was quite sure Richard was in the wrong legally. The new law about the restoration of property to those who had possessed it in the time of the old King Henry did not affect the priory's rights. Its object was to allow Duke Henry to replace Stephen's earls with his own, and thus reward people who had supported him. It was obviously not meant to apply to monasteries. Philip was confident of winning the case, but there was an unknown factor. The old sheriff had died, and his replacement would be announced today. No one knew who it would be, but everyone assumed the job would go to one of the three or four leading citizens of Shiring. David Merchant, the silk seller, Rhys Welsh, a priest who had worked at the king's court, Giles Lionheart, a knight with landholdings just outside the town, or Hugh the Bastard, the illegitimate son of the Bishop of Salisbury. Philip hoped it would be Rhys, not because the man was a countryman of his, but because he was likely to favour the church. But Philip was not overly worried. Any of the four would rule in his favour, he thought. They rode into the castle. It was not very heavily fortified. Because the Earl of Shiring had a separate castle outside town, Shiring had escaped battle for several generations. The castle was more of an administrative centre, with offices and quarters for the sheriff and his men and dungeons for offenders. Philip and Jonathan stabled their horses and went into the largest building, the Great Hall. The trestle tables that normally formed a T-shape had been rearranged. The top of the T remained, raised above the level of the rest of the hall by a dais, and the other tables were ranged down the sides of the hall, so that opposing plaintiffs could sit well apart and avoid the temptation to physical violence. The hall was already full. Bishop Walleran was there up on the dais, looking malevolent. To Philip's surprise, William Hamley was sitting with him, talking to the bishop out of the corner of his mouth, as they watched people coming in. What was William doing here? For 9 months he had been lying low, hardly moving from his village, and Philip, together with many other people in the county, had entertained the hope that he might stay there forever. But here he was, sitting on the bench as if he were still the Earl. Philip wondered what mean-minded, ruthless, greedy little scheme had brought him to the county court today. Philip and Jonathan sat down at the side of the room and waited for the proceedings to begin. There was a busy, optimistic air to the court. Now that the war had come to an end, the elite of the country had turned their attention back to the business of creating wealth. It was a fertile land, and it quickly repaid their efforts. A bumper harvest was expected this year. The price of wool was up. Philip had re-employed almost all the builders who had left at the height of the famine. Everywhere the people who had survived were the younger, stronger, healthier individuals, and now they were full of hope, and here in the great hall of Shiring Castle, it showed in the tilt of their heads, the pitch of their voices, the men's new boots and the women's fancy headgear, and the fact that they were prosperous enough to own something worth arguing in court about. They stood up as the sheriff's deputy walked in with Earl Richard. The two men mounted the dais, and then, still standing, the deputy began to read the royal writ appointing the new sheriff. As he went through the initial verbiage, Philip looked around at the four presumed candidates. He hoped the winner had courage. He would need it to stand up for the law in the presence of such powerful local barons as Bishop Walleran, Earl Richard, and Lord William. The successful candidate presumably knew he had been appointed. There was no reason to keep it secret. But none of the four looked very animated. Normally the appointee would stand beside the deputy as the proclamation was read, but the only people up there with him were Richard, Walleran, and William. The appalling thought crossed Philip's mind that Walleran might have been made sheriff. Then he was even more horrified as he heard, "Appoint as sheriff of Shiring my servant William of Hamley, and I order all men to assist him." Philip looked at Jonathan and said, "William!" There were sounds of surprise and disapproval from the townspeople. Jonathan said, "How did he do it? He must have paid for it. Where did he get the money?" "Borrowed it, I suppose." William moved to the wooden throne in the middle of the top table, smiling. He had once been a handsome young man, Philip remembered. He was still under 40, just, but he looked older. His body was too heavy and his complexion was flushed with wine, and the lively strength and optimism that makes young faces attractive had gone, to be replaced by a look of dissipation. As William sat down, Philip stood up. Jonathan got up too and whispered, "Are we leaving?" "Follow me," Philip hissed. The room fell silent. All eyes were on them as they walked across the courtroom. The public crowd parted for them to pass through. They reached the door and went out. A buzz of comment broke out as the door closed behind them. Jonathan said,
We had no chance of success with William in the chair.
Worse than that, Philip said. If we had pressed our case, we might have lost other rights.
My soul, I never thought of